Well, thank you, Liz, for that reading, and thank you, Kay, for your introduction and your welcome today. It's good to be coming to you in your home or wherever you are. We'd all much prefer that, but here we are in the situation in which we find ourselves. So we're doing the best we can, and I'm really grateful for the people who every week at our church who come and who prepare this so that we can have some spiritual content. It's not the same as being together, for sure, but at least it's something, and it's a good way for us to stay connected. And we've already heard from Kay today about how people are making efforts outside of this space and time to connect with one another and to help one another. I really think this is a really interesting series that we're doing, and I enjoyed very much Tony's message last week as he spoke about the blind man. And we're looking at, in the last part of John, Jesus meeting with people, how he interacted with them and what that meant to them. And then thinking about, well, what does that mean for us as we encounter Jesus in our lives, perhaps in similar circumstances? And today's message is also on that theme, because we're looking at the story you've heard about in the children's presentation and in the reading from Liz then. And I'm going to reinforce today as we think about Jesus encountering Mary and Martha in their grief and what he did in Lazarus' life. Actually, I was thinking that there'll be nobody who could sing like Lazarus could sing, "Death Was Arrested." And then imagine how Lazarus might sing, "I've known the goodness of God." Wow, that's amazing. And yet at a spiritual level, that was at a physical level, but at a spiritual level, that's really true for everyone who believes. We experience a spiritual new life and we experience God with us all the days of our life. So there's much to be thankful for. Most of these messages we're looking at fall in the context of, or some of these messages fall in the context of Jesus' "I am" statements. And I'm not going to go through those today, but you know, when Tony spoke last week, it comes on the back of Jesus introducing himself as the one who can bring spiritual light into people's lives, because he brought physical light into people's lives. And so he introduced himself as the light of the world. And then as we go on, we see the reaction of the Pharisees and their negative reaction to Jesus. And Jesus says, "I'm the gate." And he contrasts himself with the Pharisees and says, "I'm the good shepherd," and promises the abundance of life to people. That promise of abundance of life comes on the back of healing and restoring that man and bringing him back into community, even though, as Tony reminded us, the people, the Pharisees, couldn't see that. And so we come to today's story, where Jesus introduces himself as the resurrection and the life in the context of bringing Lazarus back to life. And what I want to do is to go back over the story. You've heard a lot of it in the children's story, you've heard it in the reading of part of the section from Liz today. I figured we couldn't read the whole 60 verses or 57 verses, I think there are. And I want to go over the story because I think it's as you enter into the story that you understand some more of the fullness of this. So Mary and Martha get a message to Jesus. I wanted to say they texted him, but they didn't have phones in those days. So they would have had to send somebody, and it looks like it was probably about a day's walk to where Jesus was, and in Perea, as I read the numbers that are in this passage. And so they send message to Jesus that Lazarus is sick. And Jesus has gone away from Bethany. He's crossed the Jordan and he's out there. We don't know exactly what he was doing out there, but he receives the message that Lazarus is ill. And when Jesus receives the message that Lazarus is ill, he says, he's sleeping, by which he means he's dead. But he says that this death is not going to end in death. He's dead already, but it's not going to end in death, but it will result in Jesus' glorification. And so we understand here that in the midst of all of this, Jesus had a bigger picture of what was going on. Mary and Martha and those who were there naturally could only see the death of Lazarus. I'm sure that when Jesus' disciples heard the news, they could only see or hear the death or the sickness of Lazarus. But Jesus says, no, there's something bigger that's going on here. And we need to remind ourselves that in the midst of grief and loss, God is often doing something bigger, something that we can't see, often something that we don't see at the time. These people were fortunate in they got a quick resolution to their situation. Often our situations don't resolve as quickly as this. And it's very hard in the midst of that sometimes to see what God is doing. But God is sovereign and God is always doing something in the midst of our circumstances. So Jesus says, I'm going to go back to Judea, because the village of Bethany was just outside Jerusalem in those days, not far at all. And Jesus says, I'm going to go back there. Now, his disciples were most concerned about this because if you read the preceding passages, really it begins at the end of John chapter 6, because from John 6 on through to John 13, where we have the beginning of Jesus last week, we have this kind of building antagonism towards Jesus on the part of the Pharisees. And they basically say, look, you can't go back there. You're going to die if you go back there. And I find it really interesting that Thomas, who often gets a bad rap because, you know, after the resurrection, Thomas said, was the one who said, you know, unless I see evidence myself, I'm not going to believe that he is raised from the dead. Thomas at this point says, well, let's go back there so we can die with him. I like that kind of, that spirit about the man. But they were quite anxious about him returning to Bethany. And of course, we know that from Bethany, things did unfold in a negative kind of way. Excuse me. And Jesus gives them a two-part answer to their concern. He says, look, there's only a certain amount of daytime. I only have a finite amount of time here. I'm paraphrasing, by the way. I only have a finite amount of time here. And while I'm here, I must do what God has for me to do. That's a good reminder, isn't it? That we all have finite time. And it's good to be about what God wants us to do in the midst of that finite time. But then he says to them, Lazarus is dead and I'm going to raise him up. So he doesn't say, don't worry about me, I'll be okay. Don't worry about me, the Pharisees won't get me. Don't worry about me, I feel safe. He says, no, I've got work to do, and the work that I have to do is to raise Lazarus to life. And so Jesus heads back towards Bethany. And Martha hears news that Jesus is on his way. She left her home and goes out to meet him on the way. We don't know how far in terms of time that was, how far she walked out to meet him and so on. And there's a conversation that takes place, first of all, with Mary and Martha, with Jesus and Martha. Then there's a conversation with Mary, and then there's some comments that the Jewish people who were there made. So Martha says to Jesus, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died. But I know now that even God will give you whatever you ask. And Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. And Martha said, I know he'll rise again at the resurrection on the last day. In other words, well, what good is that to me? You know, like, that's coming. That's not now. I need an answer now, she's saying. Jesus says, I'm the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe in me? Yes, she replied. I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who's come into the world. I want to come back to that conversation in some comments I'll make later. And then Jesus has a conversation with Mary because Mary then learns that Jesus is out there. So she goes out with some of the people who've gathered at the home. One of the great things that was happening for this family is that they were surrounded by other people who wanted to minister to them by mourning with them. We'll talk about that in a while as well. So Mary goes out and she meets Jesus. Lord, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and in trouble. And he asks her, where have you laid him? Come and see, Lord, they replied. And then the shortest verse in the whole Bible, Jesus wept. Now, what about the Jews that were with them? Well, they made the observation. When Jesus cried, they said, see how he loved him. You see, the tears that we cry when we lose somebody in this life are actually tears of love. Wouldn't it be awful if somebody could die and we can say, oh, well, that's good, they're gone. But actually, it's an expression of our love when we cry in our grief. It's an expression of our pain as well, but it's an indicator of how much we love. And the people recognize that about Jesus. But it says some of them said, couldn't he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? Now, these interactions really interest me a lot. And we'll talk about those in a moment. So then what Jesus does, he says to them, take away the stone. And of course, there's a very reasonable exception here. And this gives us an indication of how far Jesus was away, because we know that he waited 2 days before he came back. So it sounds to me like there's a day to get the message to Jesus. He waits 2 days, and then it takes him a day to get back. That would add up to 4 days if my math is correct. And they say to him, "But Lord, I think the authorized version says, 'Behold, he stinketh,' if I'm right. I think that's what it says. By this time, there's a bad odor, for he's been there 4 days. And Jesus says to him, "Then didn't I tell you that if you believe, you'll see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. And Jesus looks up and he says, "Father, I thank you that you've heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they might believe that you sent me." And when he'd said this, he called out in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." I just can't believe how people would have, imagine how people would have reacted when we get to the next bit of this story. Just put yourself in the situation of Mary and Martha and their mourners together, and Jesus cries out, "Lazarus, come out." And then it says, "Then the dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped in strips of linen and cloth around his face. And Jesus said to them, 'Take off the grave clothes and let him go.'" What an amazing story to be part of. It just blows my mind. This does not happen in our humanity. But here, Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. Now, apart from the result that Jesus came out, apart from the fact that Lazarus was now alive, apart from the fact that their grief was now pushed away because grief turns into joy here in this circumstance, you would think, wouldn't you, that everybody would be happy. But everybody was not happy. Just like the Pharisees and the teachers of the law were unhappy that Jesus healed the man born blind, they were now unhappy that he'd raised Lazarus to life. And so they make a plot to kill him. That's in the end of chapter 11. When we get into chapter 12, we see that this resurrection of Lazarus was kind of no temporary thing, because Jesus is at the meal that Greg will speak about next week, no doubt. Jesus is at the meal in his honour, and who's there reclining at the table, feasting and joining in? None other than Lazarus. So not only was he raised to life, but he was raised with a healthy appetite as well. It seems like he was functioning in every normal way as a person does. You would think, wouldn't you, that the Pharisees would be happy with that? Uh-uh. They decided, well, let's kill Lazarus. Poor guy's already been dead once, and they want to make him dead again. You see, these people, as Tony said, they kind of couldn't see the wood for the trees. They had a different mindset. And they saw these good things that Jesus was doing as a threat to their position. And so they wanted to get rid of Jesus, and then they wanted to get rid of the evidence of what Jesus had done. Very sad story. So what can we learn from this story? What do we see here in this story? The first is, I think, that grief and loss are very much a painful part of our human reality. We're all born, we all live, and we all die. And, you know, sometimes that living bit can also be filled with grief and loss. Sickness, job loss, relationship troubles, pandemics, lockdowns, all of these things can bring to us a sense of loss. I know that there are people watching this today who had great plans for what they were going to do. Not going to do those things, not in the short term anyway. I mean, it's only a month ago that my wife and I booked a trip to Tasmania on September the 24th. I'm not so sure we're going to be able to do that now. We're excited because there were cheap fares offered. We're not as excited as we were. All of that represents some form of loss, and we have to deal with those things. You know, when Peter wrote his letter, he said that in this life we'll have to suffer grief in all kinds of trials. All kinds. And that word means many-coloured. In other words, there's a variety. Here we have the trial of physical death, but throughout life there are lots of different kinds of trials. Jesus said, "In the world you will have trouble." You know, sometimes we get this idea, well, I'm a Christian, this shouldn't happen to me. Why not? We're human, aren't we? And all sorts of bad things happen to humans. Kay's referred today to those poor people in Afghanistan who are suffering really because of the Taliban coming and taking it over. But it's longer-term suffering that. It's partly to do with Western and other countries' policies towards that country and all that kind of thing. They're suffering for decisions that have been made that they had no control over. Very sad indeed. You know, the people of Haiti that Kay referred to, suffering because of a physical disaster. They had no part to play in that. They didn't ask for that. They didn't invite that. They don't deserve that in some weird kind of way. All of these things are part of our humanity. And one of the things that I think helps us is when we accept that grief and loss are part of our humanity. Because it's when we accept that that's true that we can begin to deal with it internally, that we don't push it away, that we don't try and drown our sorrows, that we don't try and fight it. Which brings me to the next thing, which is that often when we're faced with grief and loss, we want to push it away. That's what Mary and Martha were doing. Send for Jesus so my brother won't die. That's logical, isn't it? You know, if he's here, he'll fix him so he doesn't die, so he doesn't get any sicker. Now, we all do that, of course. I would suggest to you that a vaccine for COVID-19 is exactly that. You don't want to die from COVID-19, you don't want your family to die, so you go get vaccinated. That's trying to push away grief and loss. That's one way we do things to prevent it. Sometimes in our humanity, we kind of feel like, well, if I do these right steps, I can prevent bad things happening to me. I remember somebody saying to me once, you know, I'll never walk under a ladder. This was a Christian person. I'll never walk under a ladder because that will bring bad things on me. So when I see a ladder, I make sure that I skirt around that so that in that I ensure that nothing bad happens to me. That's trying to prevent grief and loss by superstitious means. The magic that exists in the world is an attempt to prevent grief and loss by superstitious means. Sometimes maybe even some of the way that we pray is a bit like that. You know, even in its own curious kind of way, COVID-19 denial is an attempt to prevent grief and loss. Because one of the things that we do in grief and loss is one of the ways that people cope with it is by denying it, by suppressing it, by pretending that it's not there. You know, if I pretend it's not there, it can't hurt me. It won't hurt me. Now, that's a little bit crazy, but that's one of the psychological things that we go through. So it's no surprise that in our culture there are some people who are denying it because it's an event, it's an attempt, whether they realise it or not, to keep it at bay. And so, you know, we invent stories around that, like, you know, it's Bill Gates and his microchip and all of that sort of stuff that's doing the rounds, but it's all an attempt to push it away. It's a very, very natural thing to do, and it's part of the process that we go through when we're experiencing grief. Now, some people push that away by denial like that. Some people resort to other pleasures to kind of reduce the pain that they're feeling. You know, they resort to alcohol or drugs or that kind of thing, or they up the amount of other pleasures in their life to kind of balance the bad things that are happening in their life. You know, I remember when I was a young person, people talked about drowning your sorrows. You ever heard that expression? You know, you're grieving or you're experiencing a loss, so you go and you get you get drunk so that you drown your sorrows. Do you know, if you do that, that's precisely what you're doing? You know, God's designed our bodies in such a way that when we cry tears of grief, our body actually, excretes in those tears the bad toxins that are in our body that we're experiencing because of our grief. And for those of you who've experienced grief, you know that foggy feeling that you get around that time? That's because your tear ducts actually take some of that back in, and that's a sedative. So when people drown their sorrows, they actually prevent this natural process that God has put in their bodies to take place. So you are literally drowning your sorrows. So really, you are better to suffer in your sorrow and work through the process, even though we naturally want to push it away. When somebody dies or when there's a grief situation, we usually look for somebody to blame. In death, we often blame ourselves. I went through this with my own father's death. I arrived at my parents' home. I'm guessing it would have been about 15 minutes after my father died. And, you know, for years, I said to myself, if only I'd known how to do CPR, he wouldn't have died. Actually, that's not true. He was well gone by the time that I was there. And yet there is a sense in which we want to find someone or something to blame. And so the inclination is we blame ourselves. And so we say, if only I'd done that. If only I'd known that. You know, if I hadn't gone to that place, if I hadn't gone at that time, that wouldn't have happened. And so we get into that kind of process. You know, that's precisely what happened in this story. See, Martha goes out and she meets Jesus and says, you know, Lord, if you'd been here, he wouldn't have died. If only, it's your fault. Mary comes out, Jesus, if you'd been here, he wouldn't have died. It's your fault. And even the mourners in that story, they said, you know, if this person who healed the blind man had been here, that man wouldn't have died. So again, it's Jesus' fault. So when we face grief, we look for somebody or something to blame. That, of course, is part of what's happening with our COVID pandemic worldwide, on a worldwide scale, and even in our lockdown. You know, it's the Chinese who started this. They're to blame, right? That's what people say. Who knows? But we want to anchor it into a blame. Or the deniers, well, this is just a conspiracy. And there are people like Bill Gates and other people behind us. They're to blame for all of this. And, you know, in our lockdown, and you read it in the newspaper every day. Quite frankly, I'm with Kay. If I had to choose between a situation where this thing ran rampant and many people died and a lockdown, I would choose a lockdown any day. I know there are social consequences and I hate the social consequences personally. I don't enjoy not being able to see people one bit. But it's always a trade-off. And I'm very sympathetic and concerned that our government leaders, who I think genuinely are trying to do the best that they can, cop it from people like me. You know, so whose fault is the pandemic? Whose fault is the lockdown? It's Dan's fault, they say. You know, well, is it, or is he trying to protect us? But again, it's this blame game thing that goes on in the midst of grief. Do I agree with all of the regulations and stuff? Do I think some of them are? No, I don't. Do I think some of them occasionally, like having the same people at church every Sunday to do the live stream, are a bit odd? Yes, I do. But in the bigger picture of things, I'm not interested in laying blame, because I think that these people are doing the best they can within the circumstances within which they find themselves. But I'm also inclined to blame, because blame is part of the grieving process that we go through, and we need to watch that. But in this story, Jesus teaches us that he's greater than life. And really, the death holds no power for those who believe. It's interesting that in this story, it's kind of Mary and Martha who are the believers, if I can put it that way. You know, Lazarus couldn't speak for himself, but they spoke for him and they said, we do believe. And Jesus demonstrates that he has ultimate power over life and death by raising this one man in the present while he was here. It's an illustration. A lot of these things that Jesus did in John's gospel were illustrative to make the point. And so he says, I am the resurrection and the life. How do they know that? Because he raised somebody from the dead and gave them a new life, and they ended up eating at a meal in Mary and Martha's house, and so alive were they that the Jews wanted to kill him. He's the resurrection and the life. And that's still true today. Jesus is still the resurrection and the life. And for everyone who dies in Jesus Christ, they will be raised to life, raised to God's life again. Yes, as that song Death Was Arrested sang, we get a new life in the moment that we believe. Whoever believes in me, Jesus says, has crossed over from death to life. That's true. But the ultimate reward, the ultimate fulfillment of that is when we're raised to life after our death, when we go to be with the Lord forever. And it's important for us to remind ourselves that irrespective of whatever happens in life, Jesus is greater than all of that. But there is, of course, this place of tension. And the place of tension is this, that I can believe that, and I do. And I can trust in Jesus, and I do. But when I'm in the midst of my grief, I need Jesus with skin on. I need people around me who can grieve with me. And so we see in the story of Lazarus that Mary and Martha had friends come out from Jerusalem and to weep with them. And when Jesus turns up and he's with them, he doesn't say straight away, I'm going to fix this. You notice that? That's not what he says when he's there with them just in that moment. But rather he weeps with them. And in our grief, we need people who weep with us. Now that weeping may be literal or it may be metaphorical. So for example, Kay was talking about people who've helped one another this week. Maybe that gift of whatever it was kind of like the weeping. It says, I'm standing with you. I'm with you. You see, when we weep with someone else, we show them that we care and we show them that we're with them. You know, the church is often about words, and I'm a words person, in case you didn't notice, but I'm a words person. And the danger for words people and the danger for church people is that often we want to give an answer. Jesus did not give a trite answer here. He didn't say, oh, God is over all, you should trust him. God will help you through this. God can make a way where there is no other way. God has a plan for your life that's bigger than... He didn't say any of that. He just wept with them. And often when we're stuck in our grief, we just need people who will sit with us and who will weep with us. You know, Job's comforters were initially a great example of this. They turned out to be no comfort at all, but when they first went to be with Job, they sat with him in silence, in sackcloth and ashes, and they just entered into his grief and his pain. It was when they started to give smart answers that they made Job's pain greater. So I say to you, when you're dealing with somebody who's in grief, you don't have to have a smart answer. Often there are no answers, or certainly no easy answers. And the truth is that because we're not God, we don't understand the whole picture of what God is doing. We don't understand the whole circumstances. But one thing we do understand, or should understand, is humanity. And that when we're in grief, we need people who will grieve with us. I go back to my own father's death. And you know, my father was not a believer. And that has its own issues when you're a believer and a member of your family is not a believer. But I remember on the day of his funeral walking out of the church and there were well-meaning Christians who shook my hand and said, I'm sure your dad is with the Lord. Now, I don't want to make any judgment about that, but that's not what I felt was the case. But they felt that they had to say something that would make me feel better. Actually, in the context of my life, it made me feel a whole heap worse. It was false comfort. See, my comfort is not in whether my dad believed or not. My comfort is in God. And I know that God is not unfair to my dad, whatever happened to my dad in terms of his destiny. God's not unfair in that. And I can live with that because I trust God. But, you know, I can still see there are about six young men. They were in a Bible study group that I ran. They were all sort of 17 and 18-year-olds, and they didn't know what to do. And they were all standing there in their black trousers and their white shirt and their black tie. And they were standing like a group of penguins, kind of looking very awkwardly like this. And as I walked past, not a soul said anything, but they all just went... And you know, that nod of understanding meant a whole lot more to me than those empty words. So let's be careful when we're ministering to people, how we minister to them. And let's make sure that's from alongside, no smart answers, but with genuine sympathy. I want you to notice, though, that Jesus is present here. And I want to remind you today that whatever you're going through, whatever you're struggling with, Jesus is present, but he wants you to know His presence. And sometimes that depends on us inviting Him in to our circumstance. You know, Peter says in 1 Peter 5 and 7 that we can cast all our anxieties on Him because He cares for us. I heard an amazing story a few years ago. I was sharing something with a person who is not at all a believer in Jesus, and they shared with me their painful story. And they said to me something which was truly remarkable for me at the time. They said, "You know, I think that Jesus was with me even when that was happening." I wondered where that came from in that person's life, given what they believed. But they felt that they'd experienced something of God in the midst of their circumstance, helping them through. But part of that, I'm sure, is inviting Him in. So I want to ask you today, what are you struggling with? Some loss of a person in your life? I know there are people who'll be watching today who've lost people in the last 12 months, but even longer term, and often we struggle with those things over the longer term. You struggling at the moment in this pandemic with what you've lost. You know, the hopes and dreams that you had to do certain things, your expectations that have been unfulfilled. Perhaps you've lost work. Perhaps you've lost relationship. Perhaps you've lost health. Jesus wants to present Himself to you. Jesus wants to weep with you. The Bible says that Jesus is our sympathetic high priest. He wants to stand alongside us and minister to our hearts. We invite Him into that place. You know, we're going to sing a song just now. And that song is that it's well with my soul. I just needed to look at my list to make sure I was saying the right song. You know, it's not always well with our soul. Not always well with our soul. Jesus doesn't always promise to change our circumstance, but He does promise to be with us in our circumstance. And if we invite Jesus in and we lean into Him and we trust Him and we cast our burden on Him, even though our circumstances are unwell, in the midst of our soul, we can experience His contentment. May I be the kind of person who trusts in Him in that way. May you also be the kind of person who trusts Him in that way and who finds Him true to His word and His person, so that you can sing, "It is well with my soul." Maybe as we reflect on this today, you can cast that burden that you're carrying on Him, knowing that He wants to shoulder you. The Lord bless you. May it be well with your soul.